The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Something that I have regretted in my life as a monk is the fact that I am not what you would call, or not what one might call, an educated Buddhist. And by this I mean I don't possess a degree in Buddhist studies. I have learned Buddhism to be polite organically and to be more honest, sort of as dogs learn, in terms of come, here, sit, fetch. Okay. This is not embarrassing. This is just the way it happened. And I was not in that way, like many Buddhists are nowadays, trained in an educational institution. Instead, I have trained in the old way, which was you go to a master and you learn from the master, and that's it. So I would call myself more a meditation monk, a practitioner, a believer, not a Buddhist scholar. Reverend Master Daizui and I had a wonderful little interaction with the head of the Theravada order in Malaysia when we were there, because he came and introduced himself, and is the custom in Eastern countries, we exchange greeting cards and business cards. And on Reverend Master Daizui's, who does come out of a long esteemed academic experience, was his educational qualifications. And the old monk said, "Oh, I see you're a doctor, and what are you a doctor of?" And Reverend Master Daizui told him. And he said, "Ah," and he was delighted, because Buddhists, especially Eastern Buddhists, love education. They think everybody should be well educated. And he turned to me and said, "And what are you a doctor of?" And I just smiled and I said, "I'm not a doctor of anything, Reverend. I'm just a monk." And he smiled even more broadly and said, "Ah, doctor of emptiness." So, in discussing this little regret with my master on a few occasions, who was a scholar, she assured me that I was much better off the way I was than subjecting my body and mind to the hammer and tongs, knives and forks of academic life. And I noticed some of the hardened academics in the audience are nodding. So there are things you know that I don't know. But anyway, I simply accepted her answer because I trusted that she knew what she was talking about, and she always seemed to have an infallible sense of what was good for me, even though I couldn't see it or had no idea of it sometimes. Now, in this part of my life, even if I wanted to, which I don't, I couldn't pursue such an interest because, number one, her warning still rings in my ears, and number two, I am constantly, I found a source of constant activity, focus, and challenge, which is called Shasta Abbey, and everything that goes on with that. And I'm quite happy with that. Don't regret it for a minute. But I bring it up to try to express to you that Buddhism possesses within it some deeply profound teachings, and certainly more than one, many varied ones depending on the tradition one is in. So deep and so varied, and in some senses so sublime that I probably will never be able to explain them to you due to my lack of knowledge and experience. However, nevertheless, regardless of that, it is the case that no matter how far you go into the Buddha Dharma, there is always farther to go. As soon as you've climbed one mountain, there's always a bigger one. You never get to it. No matter how deeply you swim in its oceans, there's always a deeper one. No matter how big the wave may be that you took last time, there's always a bigger one. And the oceans get deeper, the mountains get higher, the views become more magnificent, and the dangers increase, because the more you train, the more you realize how easy it is to make a mistake and the consequences of those mistakes. The Buddha's original experience of enlightenment and teaching has really grown throughout the centuries since his time in profundity, in meaning. And it's really become a means of universal salvation. And by salvation, I mean something that makes people happy and brings them to a state of real peace. Real peace. That everybody in this world does not recognize that, does not deter from the truth of the Buddha's teaching. Nor does it defer from its effectiveness and ability, nor does it deter from one's ability to practice it. And I think that its greatest power and its greatest merit is the simple act of simple people doing simple things over and over and over again. The teaching of the four immeasurables that we've been talking about, it, the four divine states, are these simple acts done by simple people over and over and over again. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. If we awaken these in our hearts and minds, even as possibilities, even as a desirable alternative, the way of the Buddha begins to open for us. And as I've said, all it takes is some effort and patience to put that into practice, and it begins to bear fruit. Now, the way in which metta, loving kindness, does this it provides a means and a context for us to directly experience what in Buddhism is called shunyata. Shunyata is one of these words that you can't translate into English. It's been translated in a number of different ways. Emptiness is one way. Voidness is another way. My late master called it the immaculacy of emptiness, and she described it as the fullest emptiness she had ever experienced. When you call something empty or void, it gives it a negative connotation. But what the teaching of emptiness is trying to express is that in shunyata, it is empty or void of any sense of I, me, or mine. And to take that one step further, the difficulty with I, me, or mine in Buddhism is that it is very limiting. It limits us to our own point of view, to our own suffering, to our own opinions, preconceptions, and ideas. And believe me, there is nothing you should feel more gratitude for than the fact that the universe does not function according to my opinion of it, or my feeling of the way it ought to be. If we think of these Brahmaviharas, the four immeasurables, and in particular of loving kindness, as I've told you, in the practice of loving kindness, one first learns loving kindness in relation to oneself, and that this is a good thing. I mentioned last time, is it a selfish thing? Well, yeah, in one sense it is. And I think we have to be honest when we know that in religion everybody starts off on the me side. What's in it for me? What am I going to get? I don't think there was anybody, even Shakyamuni, although he was half enlightened when he started, who don't have this, even a little soupçon of this motive kicking around in their consciousness. And the teaching of the Buddha says, as long as it doesn't stop with me, and as long as it can be extended to others, then that is all right. Once we begin, however, to practice loving kindness, to become happy, peaceful, serene, secure within ourselves, even a little bit, most of us are going to extend that in some way to others. And when loving kindness is extended to others, the me begins to fall away. And when the me begins to fall away, the I, me, and mine, or shall we say the glue that holds the I, me, and mine, begins to dissolve somewhat. the more we extend loving kindness, the more that glue weakens until eventually it can come apart completely. And we can find ourselves along with all beings living in a state of what we call in Buddhism shunyata, empty of the clinging to self, to the craving for self, in which one and all beings become a source of loving kindness, a generator of loving kindness. It gives us the opportunity to experience both ourselves and other beings as something that is no longer fixed or finite. This is its great liberative quality. And it also gives us the opportunity to see the possibility of the world around us, that it can actually be a garden of nirvana rather than a prison of samsara if more and more of us practice loving kindness. It has to start with oneself, but it can extend to others. And, you know, having a healthy dose of self is not a bad thing, because we can look at somebody and say, they're happy. Why are they so happy? What makes them happy? I mean, I'm basically the same as them, right? They're happy. Why ain't I happy? And then one begins to ask. One begins to look, and one begins to learn. In our tradition, we go immediately, I was about to say we go right for the jugular. We go immediately to the source of this fundamental clinging to self, or this fundamental ignorance, through meditation and the practice of the precepts. You work on that every day. And loving kindness comes out of this. It's something that flows naturally. Because if you're going to practice meditation and be at peace, you got to learn to be kind. One has to learn to be kind to oneself, and one has to learn to be kind to others. And this is the basis of the keeping of the precepts. The fruits of meditation and the fruits of meditation and the precepts are really the practical application of what Dogen would call charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. If you think about charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, the four immeasurables are the mind of that. They are all in there together. They all are different facets in this kaleidoscope of truth and training. Now, a few talks ago on this, I read a version of the Metta Sutra, which I'd like to repeat in order to refresh your minds. And I played fast and loose with my version of the translation, and put all the pronouns into feminine gender and was told that although this doesn't matter, it helps. And because there are more feminine genders in the audience today than male genders, I'm going to read it in that way. But it applies to everybody, no matter what. It's very short. The Karanya Metta Sutra. Who seeks to promote her welfare, having glimpsed the state of perfect peace, should be able, honest, and upright, gentle in speech, meek, and not proud. Contented, she ought to be easy to support, not over busy and simple in living. Tranquil her senses, let her be prudent and not brazen, nor fawning on families. Also, she must refrain from any action that gives the wise reason to reprove her. Then let her cultivate the thought, may all be well and secure, may all beings be happy. Whatever living creatures there be, without exception, weak or strong, long, huge, or middle-sized, or short, minute, or bulky, whether visible or invisible, and those living far or near, the born and those seeking birth, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive or decry her fellow anywhere. Let none wish others harm in resentment or in hate. Just as with her own life a mother shields from hurt her only son, her only child, let all embracing thoughts for all beings be yours. Cultivate an all-embracing mind of love for all throughout the universe, in all its height, depth, and breadth, love that is untroubled and beyond hatred or enmity. As you stand, walk, sit, or lie, so long as you are awake, pursue this awareness with your might. It is deemed the divine state here. Holding no more to wrong beliefs, with virtue and vision of the ultimate, and having overcome all sensual desire, never in a womb is one born again. Very simple, very straightforward, very feasible. And it is a scenic vista to that which is eternal and immeasurable, the simple practice of loving kindness. Now, my late master used to say that the world is a dangerous place. And even though I didn't disagree with her when she said that, I find that as I get older, I seem to be saying to myself, you can say that again. There is no Buddhist equivalent to the term hallelujah or amen. The closest we come is svaha, which is hail in Sanskrit. But I also think that it has always been this dangerous in some ways. What is really dangerous, I think, is that in the presence of imminent danger or in the presence of fear, that we become callous or cruel. And we lose sight of our own welfare and the welfare of all beings. Buddhist training, meditation, keeping of the precepts, practice of loving kindness, all these are necessary for living in a way that is harmonious and constructive. I would emphasize the word to you, constructive, because there is a tremendous amount in life that is potentially destructive. It is said that metta is the supreme means, for it forms the fundamental tenet of all the higher religions, as well as the basis for all benevolent activities intended to promote human well-being. It's not a Buddhist virtue. If it's a virtue at all, it's a human virtue. It's not solely a Buddhist practice. It is a human practice, and something that everyone can put into practice. The basis for Buddhist ethics, Buddhist morality, is what brings genuine happiness to people, genuine and lasting happiness, and what brings peace of mind. That is the basis of morality. It's the basis of the Buddhist precepts. When one's mind is peaceful, worry, restlessness, anxiety, all these things are eliminated. They're not there anymore. In terms of action in the world, we call this right action or right conduct. Doing what creates happiness for ourselves and for others. Doing what creates peace for ourselves and for others. Not for me first, and then for another, but for me and another. The two are not separate. In fact, the two are not two. They're one. So Buddhist training, in that sense, in terms of the practice of morality, the practice of loving kindness, the keeping of the precepts, the practice of meditation, is really an interesting mix of restraint and action, of things that you refrain from doing and things that you do. In order to create happiness and peacefulness for myself, there are things that I have to restrain myself from doing. And there are things that I need to do. Because if I don't restrain myself or refrain from doing something in one area, I'm going to cause suffering and pain to me. And I will also do the same to another. So it's learning what not to do, and it's learning what to do simultaneously. In terms of the simple teaching of the Metta Sutra that we talked about today, it's really clear what one does and what one does not do. What one does to be able, simply, honest and upright, gentle in speech, meek and not proud, content, easy to support, not overly busy, simple in living. Tranquil, her senses, prudent, not brazen, not fawning on families. What not to do, refraining from any action that gives the wise reason to reprove her. The combination of action and restraint creates peace, happiness, and gentleness. And from that comes the thought, may all beings be happy. May all be well and secure. And this is really good advice for those of us who may believe ourselves to be terminally crabby. Well, I don't feel loving kindness, you know, towards myself or other people. Or for those of us who feel unable, well, if I don't feel loving kindness towards myself or another, what do I do? And the answer is you do the same thing. One practices, one trains, one meditates, one keeps the precepts, one tries to be able, honest, upright, gentle in speech, meek and not proud, contented, easy to support, not overly busy, simple in living. What does that do? Well, in the words of my late master, if you throw enough mud, some's bound to stick. And the more it sticks, the more will stick. So it's something that one can begin to do right away. I can meditate, I can practice meditation. I can take precepts, I can practice precepts. I can practice loving kindness. And maybe if I don't feel particularly happy, exultant, transcendental, or immeasurably glad today, I can at least try. One has to start where one is. The idea is to begin practicing loving kindness. But as you practice it, if you really practice it, you actually become loving kindness. But you won't know it when you become it. Or you better not. You won't have fulfilled the meek and not proud part of the Metta Sutra. For those of us who have taken precepts or who are about to take them, we really need to think in terms of what I mentioned with regard to action and restraint, what I do and what I don't do. The language of the precepts in the way that we take them is a language of restraint, but it does not end with restraint. That is where it actually begins. Buddhist training is not only restraint, but it is also action. It's positive action that is expressed when the restraint part of it has been internalized and is more instinctual. There is a beautiful story, short story, that was written by a Japanese author that I've mentioned on a number of occasions because it's my favorite story, and called The Spider's Web, in which one of the characters is a real rotten person, you know, has killed all these people, thieves, is thoroughly disagreeable human being. But his one opportunity for liberation was the fact that he decided not to step on a spider at one point when he was going through the countryside. And because he decided not to step on the spider at one point, he had the opportunity later in the story for liberating himself from suffering. Now, he blew that opportunity, but nevertheless, he had an opportunity. Even in somebody that far gone, you know, murdering, thieving, etc., etc., there is the spark of loving kindness and compassion. Most of us are in a better position and can practice and do much more. When we take the precepts, when we want to practice loving kindness, yes, we are restraining ourselves. It's obvious what it is that we're restraining ourselves from. But now, what do we do? And that's one of the really wonderful things about Buddhism. It hands you your toolbox, and it says you've got these wonderful tools. They're called precepts. They're called the four wisdoms, the four immeasurables. There's loving kindness. Here, do it. And then you do it. You find the way for you in your life to do it. And you keep doing it over and over and over and over again. The simple act of simple people doing simple things can change everything. One of the most beautiful sights that one can ever see is somebody who is just starting and is very enthusiastic and keen. This is not only true in religious practice, but it's also true in pretty much anything. Because you have no experience, because you haven't done something before, you're just all keen and you just want to learn. And it's a wonderful place to be. A person is fresh, enthusiastic, willing, no sense of pride about what they're doing, because they don't yet have any experience and they haven't fallen into the inevitable trap of either competition or comparison. They're just, I want to do this. The ability to do, the ability to practice and train is not another skill at which one either succeeds at or fails. It's not a thing in that sense. The teaching of the sutra is to be honest and upright, gentle in speech, meek and not proud, and to keep doing that more and more and more and more and more in the context of here, loving kindness, meditation, the practice of the precepts, more and more and more and more and more. Step by step, one step at a time, one moment at a time, one breath at a time, one hair at a time, but more and more and more and more and more. Not just for me either, although that's where I've started and the rest of us start, but also out of a sense of being helpful to others, and of being useful to others, out of consideration for them, with the mind of sparing them inconvenience. This is why when you enter into formal religious training, the first thing you learn about is Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva who transforms herself into whatever form is necessary in order to help other beings. It's a very powerful model and example for Buddhists. She, in one of her depictions, she has 1,000 hands, 1,000 eyes, to see in all directions, to help in all directions. You can imagine yourself being a kid monk turning up in a monastery, being taken to a hall by someone who's been there a long time to see one of these statues, and they look at you and say, "See that? That's what you've got to become." Not that you believe in that, but you actually have to become that. To see, to help, to respond. To do that for oneself, surely, and to do it for others. Because it cannot be for oneself alone, and it cannot be for others alone. It must be for both, because both are in fact one thing. There is a chapter in Zenna's Eternal Life that, if I had a way of imprinting it in my mind, I'm sure somebody will come up with a computer that does this one day, where it would pass across the inside of my glasses, you know, like every half hour. I would do that and make that required programming for all monks. It's amazing what you can learn about the monks in your monastery by just watching what they do. This is one of my little secrets. I can hear all sorts of things when we talk. Number one, everybody's on their best behavior when they're going to talk to the abbot anyway. Okay, number one. And you're all very kind that way, reverence. But I can always tell how they're really doing by observing them in daily life. I watch the way they bow. I watch the way they speak to each other. I watch how they carry themselves, how they relate to the space around them, to each other, to the community. And you can, from that, you can see the extent of the person's spirituality. The talking is nice. Okay. But it is the being and the expression of that being that is the important thing. You can see how the heart of the training is actually permeating body and mind and expressing itself. I see this with the monks. I see this with all of you. You have no idea how impressive it is. I remember when I would go down to San Francisco and teach at University of California, which I spent many, many years helping Reverend Master doing it, and then ended up having to do it for myself. And you'd see people come in off the street, so to speak, didn't know anything about meditation practice, and they'd sit there, and in 5 to 10 minutes, they were really sitting. The simple acts of simple people doing a simple thing can have profound consequences. And you must always keep in mind, this is something I can do. This is something I can practice. And I don't even have to feel like it. And it's no more, it's actually even a lot less complicated than jogging, for example. I'm sorry. Because all you have to do is put your mind in that direction and you're already doing it. You don't even have to put your tennis shoes on. All you need is to focus the mind. See, right there. So this is how an abbot, a teacher, is receiving constant data and input in the actual bodies and minds of the monks and the people that he or she teaches. Because, and that is the way that you gauge the effectiveness of what you are doing, is whether or not other people can understand it and whether or not they express it. And it is not one's own teaching. It is not my teaching. It's the teaching of the Buddha. And if they do not understand it, one has to be a better teacher. One has to give a better example. One has to practice the Dharma more deeply. One has to be able and willing to show what is possible. And this is also true for all of us, to practice loving kindness, to be compassionate and not cruel, not to forget because we're afraid or we're upset or we're grieving, not to forget to rejoice in the joys and achievements of others. And not to become so attached that we are constantly caught up in what we like, what we don't like, what we want, what we don't want, but can just sit there with some sense of equanimity. This is why they are called immeasurable. It takes down, it helps to disassemble what we would call the house builder of the house of ego. But more importantly than that, it dissolves away the walls. And when the walls dissolve away, there is so much there that it is immeasurable. May all beings be well and secure. May all beings be happy. I used to think, God, that's so simplistic. It is so true. Thank you, friends.